Welcome to Minnesota Military Radio, where we bring you information about Minnesota's National Guard, the military community, Beyond the Yellow Ribbon Program, and Department of Veterans Affairs. Your host is Tom Lyons, founder and owner of Phalon Partners Limited, a Twin Cities merger and acquisition advisory firm. Tom is also a Vietnam veteran of the United States Air Force and a member of the VFW and American Legion. Now, here's Tom Lyons.
Welcome to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. On today's show, we're going to take you back to the Tet Offensive of 1968 with a Vietnam veteran from Minnesota. And we'll learn how therapy dogs are helping our wounded service members. But first, it's time for Generally Speaking, a weekly message from the Adjutant General of the Minnesota National Guard, Major General Rick Nash.
During the month of April, the state of Minnesota takes time to recognize the month of the military child. The purpose of this special month is to emphasize the important role military children play while a parent or an important adult in their life is serving. We are learning from our children that a life for a military child isn't the same as for their peers. They have a unique set of pressures as their loved one is deployed. The children worry about a loved one in harm's way. They also endure extra stress both at home and in school when a parent is gone for extended periods of time. While many of our military youth are part of the Minnesota National Guard family and call a Minnesota community home, some have parents in the active duty or reserves and may face numerous moves as a result of their parents' assignments. The worry, stress, and moves all make normal childhood activities difficult. It is estimated that over 15,000 children in Minnesota have been affected by a parent's deployment. During the month of April, Governor Dayton will send a military child a letter of gratitude in honor of their service and sacrifice. I encourage all military parents to register their sons and daughters to receive a letter from the governor. It's a simple process that will warm the heart of your child and make them feel extra special for enduring their role in your military family. To register your child, visit beyondtheyellowribbon.org and click on the events and deals.
Thank you, General Nash. For more information, please go to minnesotamilitaryradio.com. Joining me now is a native of Minnesota who wrote a book called Just War, A Soldier's Revelation, and who served in Vietnam with the 101st Airborne Division in 1968. His name is Tom Newman. Tom, welcome to Minnesota Military Radio.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate being here.
Tom, it's been a few years now since you and I served in Vietnam, and you were there a few years before me in one of the toughest years in the war. But can you share with our listeners, how did you become a soldier? What enticed you to go into the military?
Well, it's kind of a long story. In my junior and senior year of high school, I bought a motorcycle. And need for speed, I guess. And I got accumulated several speeding tickets, 7 to be exact. And I was in front of the judge for the last one. He said he was going to take away my license. And that didn't provide many opportunities for somebody living in the suburbs for employment or going to school. And so I told him I was about listing in the Army. And he said, well, if you do that and show me your papers, we'll just let all this go. So I thought about it, and I felt that what we were doing in Vietnam was an honorable adventure because people were being oppressed and they were going to be forced under a government that they didn't want. So I decided to enlist in the Army. I asked to be a paratrooper. I volunteered for the infantry, and I volunteered for duty in Vietnam.
Tom, I understand at one point you wanted to drive helicopters, but you had a little problem.
I did. When you first enter the military, you're subject to a battery of tests, and they go on for a couple days. And when that's done, the military says, okay, we have a best fit for you based on your skills, talents, abilities. And the two options they gave me were OCS, Officer Candidate School. So at 18 years old, I would go into OCS. 6 months later, I'd be a lieutenant. And I told the officer that I didn't think at 18 years old, with 6 months of schooling, I'd be qualified to be in charge of the lives of 50 men. So I took the second option, which was to be a helicopter pilot, and I reported the first day, and they discovered I was left-handed, and they said, left-handed people can't fly helicopters. You see everything backwards, you react backwards, so when you get in the thick of things, you're gonna crash the bird. So my two options for other than what I had originally signed up for, infantry paratrooper, neither of them panned out.
So you proceeded to go through some rigorous training, for quite a while, and you volunteered for Vietnam.
Correct. Basic training about 2 months, and then advanced infantry training, and then jump school for 3 weeks to be a paratrooper. I had applied for Ranger School, and as soon as I got accepted, my orders came in for Vietnam, so I never had the opportunity to go to Ranger School.
We're speaking with Tom Newman, a Vietnam veteran from Minnesota, on Minnesota Military Radio. Tom, let's take the listeners back to 1968 and even before that, the war in Vietnam. You call it a just war. Why is that?
Well, to understand our involvement in Vietnam, you have to go back in history a little bit. And it actually started in 1947 under President Harry Truman when he established the Truman Doctrine, which was pledging U.S. support to any free nation sovereignty that was experiencing attempts to displace its democratic government. And the Truman Doctrine, which actually just gave further support to the SATO Treaty, which was signed after World War II, which was an agreement for all the signees for mutual protection and defense if they were experiencing hostile efforts to topple the government after the close of World War II. And most of this was started because Harry Truman was very suspect of Stalin, because Stalin didn't meet any of the timetables for withdrawing his troops from the countries that he occupied in the war against Germany. Our focus was on Vietnam at the time, but at the same time, the communists were trying to take over the governments of Malaysia, Burma, and the Philippines. By the time the French withdrew from Vietnam in 1954, we had had advisors on the ground at that time, and we'd given them $1 billion in aid. In 1950, President Truman established the MAG, which was the Military Assistance Advisory Group, which actually put U.S. soldiers and advisors in country in 1950. The U.S. also signed the Mutual Defense Assistance Agreement with France, Vietnam, Thailand, and Laos. And in 1953, with the end of hostilities in Korea, China significantly increased its aid to North Vietnam. And within a year, Ho Chi Minh's forces defeated the French. In 1954, France withdrew from French Indonesia. At the same time, Stalin had promised Ho Chi Minh unlimited manpower and resources if he could subdue French Indonesia. In effect, both China and Russia were vying for the loyalty of Ho Chi Minh to get Vietnam to be a satellite of their respective communist regimes. President Eisenhower, wanting to keep the spread of communism in check after World War II and with the departure of the French, sent increasingly more aid and military advisors into South Vietnam. And that was inherited by JFK, and after his assassination, passed on to President Johnson and Nixon.
So, Tom, what you're saying here is right after World War II, the United States and our allies were essentially trying to combat communism and fighting war by proxy, and the history of Vietnam is such that both sides got behind some side, and the French were in there, and the French got beat, and before we knew it, we were involved.
Right.
And then, of course, that was for quite a few years before you were assigned and went to Vietnam in 1968.
Correct.
Oh, you went to basic training and were training and paratrooper and all of this, and when did you know you were part of the 101st?
Well, I took my basic training because I had enlisted to be a paratrooper. They sent me to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, which is the home of the 101st, and that's where I took my basic training. Then I was transferred to Georgia for the AIT, and then back to the 101st because the 101st was being actively deployed to Vietnam. They were sent there in December of 67. So they were trying to fill in their ranks at that time. So I went to the 101st rather than the 82nd Airborne.
Yeah, and you went to Vietnam in, was it February 1968?
Correct. Yes.
And you knew at that time that you were assigned to the 101st Airborne.
I did.
How did you feel about that, Tom?
The 101st Airborne has a good reputation. They've always carried the brunt of America's involvement in armed conflict. And so I was pretty proud to be a member of the 101st.
It was a legendary division in World War II, and a lot of guys were pretty proud to join them.
Absolutely.
And then you got to Vietnam and you found out what war was all about.
I certainly did.
Tom, we're going to have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to take our listeners back to 1968 when you hit Vietnam and what that war was like and what it was all about. We're speaking with Tom Newman, author of Just War, A Soldier's Revelation on Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons, and we've been speaking with Tom Newman, author of A Just War, A Soldier's Revelation, and who was assigned to the 101st Airborne Division in Vietnam in 1968. So, Tom, we've heard about how the war was set up and how we got to Vietnam and how you got to be a paratrooper. And tell me about that first day then you got off the plane in Vietnam. Was that a little shock to the senses?
Yeah, I've never experienced that kind of heat and that kind of humidity. And the smells of the environment were completely different than anything I'd been exposed to. It was the first realization that you were definitely somewhere else.
Somewhere different, too.
Right.
So, Tom, what area did the 101st work within, and in what part of that division were you a member of?
Well, part of the 101st was in Saigon, and the other part was up in I Corps, which is the northernmost portion of South Vietnam. I got in a plane, flew to Phu Bai, and I got off the plane, and the sergeant there said, somebody put you on the wrong plane. You were supposed to be in Ben Hoa, which would have been permanent bunker guard duty, and I have thoughts about that. But he said the 101st is right in the middle of the Tet Offensive, so they desperately need replacements, so I'll just change your orders and we'll send you out to Wei. So that was my first introduction. I joined the 101st, 502nd. We were called First Strike because we were the modern-day equivalent of the cavalry. If any American forces were in trouble or in jeopardy, we would saddle up if we weren't otherwise engaged and go to their rescue. I made 74 helicopter insertions, and 54 of those were into hot LZs.
Tom, 1968, any of us that were here remember the Tet Offensive. Can you explain to our listeners what the North Vietnamese were trying to do there?
The Tet Offensive was like the Battle of the Bulge. It was a last-ditch effort to try and get a victory. And it was staged all across South Vietnam. They attacked 160 different cities and villages, the two most ferocious fighting was Saigon and Wei. The Marines were inside of Wei as well as the Black Panthers, which is a South Vietnamese Ranger battalion. So the fighting was contained within Wei. The 101st Airborne had a cordon around Wei to prevent anyone from getting out or supplies and reinforcements from getting in. And unfortunately, what that entailed is we would set up ambushes at night for people that were trying to come into Wei, and we would go through the tunnels during the day to try and get their supplies and break up their resupply and their reinforcement efforts. When the war was actually over in Wei, the communists never really had possession of Wei at all times because the Marines and the Black Panthers were inside the whole time. But when the fighting was over and we retook Wei, we found shallow graves that had 2,800 people that were politicians, lawyers, doctors, professors that the communists had systematically assassinated during their 30-day tenure within the city of Wei. So when Wei fell, it was a very political decision because it was the citadel was hundreds and hundreds of years old. Nobody really knew who built it, but they were trying to preserve that. But it gets to the point in time where you've got to make a decision about winning the battle. So we called in airstrikes and took out the citadel, and that's where most of the communists were holed up.
Tom, as I read your book, it sounds like within a very short period of time, they figured out you were particularly good at being on point and going into tunnels.
Well, that's true. But going on point, and that was primarily because I have everybody's eyes is automatically drawn to movement, but I have a very good ability to sense things that are moving or things that don't fit naturally in the geographic area. So I defaulted to point right away because I saw everything. Nothing missed me. And that's the point of the point man. He's 200 yards ahead of the company in the rice paddies, and he's 50 yards ahead in the jungles. And he's to identify any point of danger before the rest of the company gets in a kill zone and is ambushed. The other part of it is when you go into a tunnel, at that time I was 145 pounds. I've got black hair. It didn't take long to get a good suntan in Vietnam. So I could be mistaken for a Vietnamese. And so when you go into a tunnel, if there was ever a question or a doubt, the people, rather than engage, would just take off because they weren't sure. But if an African American or a guy that's red hair and fish belly white and 250 pounds go down in a tunnel, it's instant identification. So it was basically because of these abilities that, number one, I could be mistaken for a Vietnamese, so they wouldn't engage me, that they liked me to be a tunnel rat, and number two, my uncanny ability to see anything that moved or didn't fit in with the rest of the environment, that brought me to the position of point.
We're speaking with Tom Newman, Vietnam veteran from Minnesota, on Minnesota Military Radio. Tom, my understanding is most of the guys are on point last about 11 days out there, and you were in combat for 250 days. And I know in your book there were several instances where you survived some things that most people wouldn't. Can you tell us a couple of those?
Certainly. One time we had come around a hedgerow after we'd crossed a river, and there was a plot of trees about 100 meters by 300 meters. And we swept through the trees and couldn't find anyone, so we assumed that they were all under the trees in tunnels. So we called in an airstrike, and the CO pulled all the troopers back and stationed the three-point men around the wooded area. And my position was on the long axis of the woods. And the two F-4s came in and dropped their 500-pound bombs, only to have one of them bounce out of the woods and come tumbling at me end over end. I knew that I couldn't run in the mud of the rice paddies, and I would have never gotten away in time anyhow. So I just watched the bomb tumble towards me, and when I looked at this unexploded bomb that landed 15 feet in front of me, I just said, I get this. You're in control of all these situations. It's got nothing to do with my training or my abilities. There was another time where we had...
And by that you mean a higher power was in control.
A higher power, absolutely.
And the reason it bounced, that was a reinforced concrete above an underground tunnel, wasn't it?
The woods was an underground hospital. And it had a concrete ceiling, 148 beds.
So you survived a close one that day, Tom.
I did.
And there were several other instances that were pretty scary, it sounded like.
Well, one time when we were online, we'd typically get online, span out, and then go through the hedgerows, because hedgerows surrounded all the villages. And as we'd go through the hedgerows, we never really knew what we were coming out on the other side, because it was pretty thick and pretty dense. And on this one occasion, as I came through the hedgerow, there was a pink stucco building, which was unusual for anywhere in Vietnam. Most of the dwellings that people lived in were straw hooches made out of just vegetation. But we came through the hedgerow, and there was a house. I stopped to take a look to make sure nobody was inside, and then there was a sidewalk of sorts that paralleled the house and a hedge and went down to the river. And there was a trooper on the other side of the hedge, but because I had stopped, he got ahead of me, and he reached the end of the pathway before I did and tripped a booby trap when he got down there. And if I had been parallel to him, I would have been wounded as well. But I went to his aid. I called for the medic, and I remember thinking, if I could just stop the blood from coming out, he's going to be okay. The medic arrived, and he said there was too much blood. He couldn't see anything. He needed some water. And I told one of the guys that grab some helmets and go back up the sidewalk. I just came down because there's a rain barrel at the corner of the house, and that's where you can get your water. So he grabbed the helmets, started up the path I had just come down. He got halfway up the path and hit a booby trap that took both of his legs. And we lost both of the troopers that day. And I remember feeling that I have never felt so absolutely helpless and so absolutely useless as when you try and save somebody's life and fail.
Tom, 1968 was one of the bloodiest years of the war in Vietnam. And your unit, the 101st Airborne, sustained 97% casualties and fatalities.
That's correct.
That's astounding.
It is astounding. But like I said, we were first strike. We were the modern-day equivalent of the cavalry. And after the Tet Offensive in Hue, most of our operations after that were in the Ashaw Valley. And that was, of course, a scene of fierce fighting throughout the war because it was a direct access off the Ho Chi Minh Trail into the I Corps. And soldiers of the Ashaw Valley on both sides earned a reputation for valor and for... being able to do the tough jobs.
Tom, and I understand there was a fire base that your unit developed that you named after a World War II battle.
Absolutely. Bastogne.
And there's some pretty fierce fighting up there, too.
That's where we deployed into the Ashaw Valley from. That was our resupply point. And that's where we had our artillery support once we went into the valley.
It was a long year, and you lost a lot of buddies.
I sure did, yes.
How do you reflect on that, Tom?
Well, when I first came back, I had survivor's guilt. As I suppose anybody would that goes through that. But the way I work through that is Psalms 139, verse 16 says that the day you're born, before you live one day, the day of your death is entered into the books. And when you reflect on, we have 47,500 people that die in this country every week, that it kind of falls into place. It's not you being singled out. That's just the course of the consequence of life and death.
Well, we all have memories of Vietnam, but the combat vets, that especially the ones that fought in the 101st in 1968, those of you that made it, wow, I salute you, sir.
Thank you.
We have time. We have to take a short break. When we come back, there's one more story I'd like you to tell our visitors. This is Minnesota Military Radio. We're going to take a short break. Please stay with us. We'll be right back with Tom Newman, Vietnam veteran from Minnesota.
Hi, this is Bill Popp of the Minnesota Military Family Foundation. An Army squad is made up of 8 soldiers, and when the squad is on patrol, each soldier is dependent on each other for safety. When a soldier is distracted because of a financial crisis with the family back home, that puts every soldier on the squad at risk. The Minnesota Military Family Foundation helps turn a bad situation into a positive one. The foundation provides financial support during a financial crisis at home. This helps re-energize the soldier. The soldier feels the financial burden lifted and has feelings of pride because of the support from the community at home. When the soldier is no longer focused on the financial crisis at home, the soldier is able to stay engaged in the mission and do his duty to protect other soldiers in the squad. When we help one soldier, we're helping all soldiers. When we help one military family, we're helping all military families. If you're in a position to help, please donate. Go to MinnesotaMilitaryFamilyFoundation.org.
Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons, and we've been visiting with Tom Newman, author of Just War, A Soldier's Revelation, and a Vietnam veteran who served with the 101st Airborne Division in 1968 during the Tet Offensive and all the battles afterwards. Tom, there was one story in your book, and in the first story you told me when we first met, you had a little encounter on a mission with some wasps. Can you tell us about that?
Sure, thanks. We had good information, good intelligence that a village that had been deserted was now occupied by the NVA, and we always tried to get to them before they could muster enough support and hook up with the VC and perform their operations. So we came in over the South China Sea on whisper mode in our Hueys and landed on the beach about 3 a.m., and the plan was to advance on the village just before daylight and try and take them by surprise. So as we were advancing through the hedgerows, the trooper next to me struck a wasp nest with the butt of his rifle, and the wasp swarmed on me, stinging me 11 times in the head and the neck. And the wasps are called giant black wasps. They're about an inch and a half in length and pretty good bulk to them. So I immediately stopped advancing. I sat down because the pain was so severe from the stings, and I called for the medic. He came up to me and saw the wasp. He knew exactly what had happened. He told the CO that I had a potential for going into anaphylactic shock, so I should be medevaced. And the CO said, we can't bring in a medevac. It'll give our position away. So we had to wait until the troops engaged the village, and then the medevac came and took me to LZ Sally. By the time we got there, I didn't have any facial features. My face was so swollen from the bee venom. They put me on a gurney and brought me to the emergency room. And when they brought me in, the doctor looked at me, and I didn't have any facial features. My face was completely smooth. And he said, what in the hell happened to him? And I don't think he knew how to treat me. So as soon as I heard him say that, I realized that one of the wasps had stung me in the mouth, and I bit down just to stop the pain. So I pulled the wasp out of my mouth and went into anaphylactic shock. I suffered cardiac arrest and complete respiratory failure. As soon as I flatlined, my spirit and my soul left my body, and I just kind of went above myself on the operating table and watched the procedures to resuscitate me. One of the things that I was thinking about when I was in that position is, if I can see them, why can't they see me? And I looked at my hand, and it was translucent. I could see through it. So the reason they couldn't see me is because I was translucent. But I remember that I was fully conscious. It was still every bit the person, personality of Tom Newman. And once they resuscitated me, I went back into my body, and that's when I blacked out. The next day in the recovery room, as I was waking up, I was trying to get my head around that. I just existed outside of my body. It's hard to put it into context because it's so far removed from any experience you've ever had before. And I was thinking, how can I verify that empirically? And just about that time, the orderly was coming through, and he said, "They see you're coming around. How you feeling?" And I said, "I got a question for you." I said, "Why are you guys putting blood in one arm and taking it out of the other?" With a very surprised look on his face, he said, "Man, how the hell do you know we did that? You were gone." And I guess that's what I needed to hear, because if it hadn't been a real-life experience for me, I wouldn't have known the procedures they used to resuscitate me. So that gave me a certain conviction, and I kind of look at, I call this reality we live in, these three-dimensional touch and feel reality, provisional reality, and the one on the other side of the veil I call foundational reality, which is our spiritual reality.
Tom, that's an extraordinary tale, and as I read it in the book, the hair was standing up on the back of my neck, but that orderly certainly convinced you that it was real. Yes. You went through more than any one man should have had to go through in 250 days of combat in Vietnam. How did you cope with it? How did you make it through, and how have you made it to this point in life?
Well, I think the one thought I kept holding on to is God wouldn't be putting me through this if there wasn't a reason. And it sounds like just a simple statement, but when you're in the worst of it, and that's the thought that always comes to your mind, I guess you have to say that's what got you through it.
Somebody was helping you through it.
Somebody was helping you through it. And by the time you go through 26 experiences where you should have been died or severely wounded, you get a sense of divine perfection or divine intervention, and you get to the point where you think you're bulletproof.
And what did you pull out of that you applied to your life since?
Well, when I came back, I had a lot of questions, and I couldn't just blow it off. I had to find the answers to these things. So I went to the University of Minnesota. I majored in psychology and philosophy, trying to find the answers, but that's a secular environment. I didn't have any of the answers that I had about God and death and life and eternity and other dimensions. So when my kids were born, I thought, okay, now I'm responsible for the eternal destiny of two souls. So I started to read Scripture. And I'd get up at 5 in the morning so I could have an hour of Scripture before I start my daily routine. And as I was doing that, I came to the realization that this is where I'm finding the answers to all those questions I had that have been lingering since Vietnam. I started taking notes. The notes turned into paragraphs, into pages, into treatises. And that was once I found all the answers and I told my kids I'd found the answers, they said, well, if you found them, there might be other people looking for them. Why don't you put it in a book? And that's the subject of my second book, A Brief History of the Bible, which is the essentials of Christianity within the context of our physical and spiritual realities. So I guess that's what brought me through it, and that's what keeps me going through it from today.
It's extraordinary, Tom. We've got about 30 seconds left. What would you say to our young people today that are thinking about signing up and serving their country in the military?
Well, the one thing that the United States has always been blessed with is whenever our national sovereignty is challenged, we have about 10% of the populations that's willing to step up and take on the responsibilities of putting on the uniform and taking up arms against anyone that threatens that sovereignty. And as long as we've been blessed with that in the past, let's hope and pray that we continue to be blessed with that in the future.
Tom, thanks for joining us today in Minnesota Military Radio.
Thank you.
There's Tom Newman, one of Minnesota's own, Vietnam veteran from 1968, United States Army, and the author of Just War, A Soldier's Revelation. Joining me now from the flag line of the Minnesota Patriot Guard is Tim Leonhard. Tim, welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio.
Well, thank you, Tom.
How are your riders doing this month?
They're doing just fine. Had some interesting missions. We had a KA down in Waseca we spanned about 3 days and had lots of support for that. And it was a pretty intense mission.
Anytime we lose a young Marine corporal or young serviceman from any of the branches, it's a tough day.
It is. It is. You know, you know that they are out there fighting for our freedoms.
And it's got to be an honor to be out on the line.
It's honor, dignity, and respect is what we want to do for all these young men and women that serve for us.
Tim, you brought a fellow rider with you again.
I did. I have Joe Egan here with me today, assistant ride captain from the Northwest Metro.
Joe, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
What's on your mind today, Joe?
Well, interesting. The other day I was taking a look at the Patriot Guard website and taking a look at a lot of the photos that are posted on there and trying to find some common facial expression that is typical of a Patriot Guard member. And aside from the military homecomings, that's about the only time you see a photo of happiness and smiles on the face, and for good reason. But the majority of the other pictures pretty much match our tagline of honor, dignity, and respect. And honor, not something that the Patriot Guard member is asking for, but rather something that they're giving. And then the other one is dignity, having the conviction to not tolerate what is intolerable. And then also respect, twofold, respect for the fallen hero, and also respectful compassion for the mourners. But the other look that I saw on their face was a look of freedom. And it's something that we don't take for granted. And unfortunately, it's appreciated most when it's taken away. And for all those expressions of the Patriot Guard is why I'm really proud to be part of this organization.
And Joe, I'll bet when you're looking at those pictures, one other thing was common. It's a pretty, most of those missions are emotional. There are a lot of dark glasses on the riders.
Well, we once had a police escort with taking us through on a funeral, and it is very emotional, especially when you have a lot of people on the route coming out where some senior citizens are coming out of the nursing home with their walkers waving flags. And at the end, a law enforcement officer said, "Do you guys shed tears?" I go, "Yeah, that's why we wear the sunglasses." But really, tears is just emotions coming out of your eyes, and it's not a weakness.
And at the end of the day and the end of the mission, you get more than you give, don't you?
Absolutely.
Tim, who's eligible to be a Minnesota
anybody,
Patriot Guard rider?
Anybody. Anybody that has an American flag, good heart, and honor, dignity, and respect for our military.
And even us guys that drive around in cages.
And even people in cages.
They won't make fun of us. We can come out and do the same thing.
Nope.
Tim, your Minnesota Patriot Guard riders are doing a fantastic job in all the missions you go on. It's been a cold winter. Everybody get through okay?
They have.
That's good. I'm glad we didn't get anybody injured in all those 50 days that were below zero.
No, one of our biggest things is safety, trying to make sure our members and everybody around us are safe.
Well, Tim, make sure you take care of all those riders, and we look forward to having you back next month.
We do. Thank you. Thank you, Tom.
That was Tim Leonhardt and Joe Egan from the flag line of the Minnesota Patriot Guard. Coming up next, we'll learn how therapy dogs are helping our wounded service members. Please stay tuned. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. In a moment, we're going to learn how therapy dogs are helping our wounded service members. But first, it's time for the Commissioner's Corner, a weekly update from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Now here's Commissioner Larry Shelato.
After leading our five state veterans homes for 2 years, Michael J. Gallucci, Deputy Commissioner of Veterans Healthcare, has retired. Although this was a tough decision for Mike, ultimately it came down to making retirement a reality and spending more time with his family. Mike is a retired Command Sergeant Major with over 35 years of service to military members, veterans, and their families. When Mike accepted this position 2 years ago, it was clear he viewed it as an opportunity to continue to work with veterans. Under his leadership, the Veterans Home team has established some significant bragging rights, including the groundwork for telemedicine and medical record sharing, and also medical certificate advances and the opening of the Adult Day Center. The Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs wishes Mike all the best in his future endeavors.
Thank you, Commissioner Shelato. For more information, please go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. Joining us now is the founder of Pets Loyal to Vets, Jeff LeBaron. Jeff, welcome to Minnesota Military Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Jeff, I understand you were in the United States Navy.
Yes, I was.
Can you tell us a little bit about when and where you served?
Yes, I was on a USS Robeson, DDG-12, based out of San Diego. And I picked the ship up while I was stationed in Subic Bay in the Philippines. And from that point on, served on the deck weapons crew, where we handled the weapons and resupply missions and things like that.
And that was back right towards the end of the Vietnam War, which we just heard about with Tom Newman.
Yes, it was. I wish I was. I had been old enough to sign up a couple of years earlier, so I could have served in actual combat zones, but I was glad to serve when I did.
But you served, and I understand you had a couple injuries.
Yes, I did. I sustained a few injuries while on board ship, and then those ended up causing some problems for me later in life. So I ended up dealing with PTSD and traumatic brain injury.
So Pets Loyal to Vets, where did that idea come from?
Well, I initially, as I was going through my own therapies at the VA hospital in Minneapolis, I had a good understanding of what other veterans were going through along with the therapy programs and what I was going through. And at the end of the program, I talked with a lot of the veterans that I had met that their dogs were having a significant effect on their well-being and their quality of life after they left the programs. And so I started to look for a way that I could pay it back. Since I wasn't able to stay in for 20 years and serve, I wanted to find a way that I could pay it back to fellow veterans. And one of the programs I went through there was called Prolonged Exposure Therapy, and that acronym was PET, and that led to the formation of Pets Loyal to Vets.
And so let's talk about these service dogs. You refer to them in your materials as psychiatric service dogs. What do you? I assume you start with just a puppy or a dog. How do you turn them into something special for the veterans?
Well, it depends on the veterans' needs. We have companion therapy and psychiatric service dogs, and the psychiatric service dog is a much higher level of training that will go into that dog to facilitate the needs of the veteran. And so it's a program that's, we're going to have fewer people in that program based on the number of veterans that'll come in for therapy dogs versus companion dogs. The psychiatric side of things is it's a much more difficult area to train dogs in, and we'll have skilled psychiatric service dog trainers that will come in there and handle that for the veterans.
So what do these trained dogs do for the veterans?
Well, they help them deal with anxiety and panic attacks and what most people refer to as flashbacks while they're sleeping and they have nightmares. And they will be able to help them with the challenges that they go through on a psychiatric level.
Now, we've had some these therapy dogs in, not yours, but we've had them in with their vets, and it appears that they visibly settle down some of the veterans, and they relax a little bit. Is that true?
Yeah, it's very much true. My dog helps me out a lot. Many veterans I talk with, too, their dogs have been instrumental in helping them calm down in a variety of situations, from public situations to situations at home or when they're alone.
We're speaking with Jeff LeBaron, the founder of Pets Loyal to Vets on Minnesota Military Radio. Jeff, how long does it take to train a dog for either of these purposes?
A companion dog is it's through a canine good citizen. You're through obedience 1 and 2, and you get your CGC certification. That's about 6 weeks. And a therapy dog is going to be certified is about 6 to 9 months. It depends on how fast the dog will learn. A psychiatric service dog will anywhere between 12 and 15 months, and it could be up as far as 24 months.
Now, is Pets Loyal to Vets a nonprofit organization?
Yes, we are. We're a 501c3 registered nonprofit organization in Minnesota.
And how long have you been doing this?
Well, I founded this 2.5 years ago, but the organization itself has been a viable organization through the state for about 14 months now.
And how many dogs have you trained so far?
Well, we are not in the training process because we're in the fundraising mode right now so that we can then finish the interior of our building so that we can then start our training and then get these dogs in the hands of veterans.
Do you know how much demand there is for these dogs?
The demand is very high. Right now, we've got 12 veterans on our waiting list that are waiting for a dog.
And how does a veteran get on the waiting list, and how do they qualify for a dog?
Sure. Qualifications are basically they have to be a Minnesota resident or live in Pearson, St. Croix County, Wisconsin. Most of the veterans that live there also work in Minnesota. The qualifications are that they have to have been honorably or medically discharged because of their PTSD or traumatic brain injury or physical assault trauma. It doesn't matter what branch, service, rank, or gender, or anything like that. They have to be able to take care of their dog. They have to be within a certain distance of a veterinary hospital. So if they're in outstate Minnesota, they have to be able to take that dog and care for that dog. So it's the qualifications are through the VA hospitals that their doctor feels that veteran, it's a necessary part of their rehabilitation or ongoing treatment to have a dog.
So were these first veterans referred to you by the VA hospital?
I've had two that have come from the VA hospital right now, and the rest of them have found out about us on the internet.
And how long do you think it's going to be before you actually start training these animals?
We're hoping to have phase 1, 2, 3 completed by midsummer so that we can start our training by the latter part of summer.
And actually, you've practiced this with your own dog so far, right?
Yes, I do.
And what's your dog's name? And
my dog's name is Riggs, short for Wrigley. He's a chocolate lab, Chesapeake, and Doberman mix.
Okay. And we were talking earlier, now, if these veterans get these dogs and for some reason they have to go back into the hospital for an extended period of time for some treatment, what happens to the dogs?
Well, the doctors have explained to us is that the veterans that don't have a place to put their dog when they come to the hospital, they don't have a family or they don't have a daycare for the dogs nearby. We will then take the dogs in for them and even bring their dogs down to the VA hospital on weekly visits so that they can still bond with their dog while they're in there getting the help that they need.
And of course, this is like any human dog relationship. They bond. Only for these veterans that have some issues, it's even more important, isn't it?
It's very important. And if you ask any veteran out there that's got a dog that has helped them through a lot of the challenges that they have, they will tell you how important it is.
So your website is petsloyal2vets.org. And how can our listeners help?
Well, they can help us with donations. We're looking for corporate or foundation sponsorships. We take donations online. We have a variety of different ways that they can contribute materials for the renovation of our building. We have a lot of sponsors on board right now. And they can contact us at 612-396-3369 or through our website. And we'd be glad to work with them.
And the website's petsloyal2vets.org, and we'll have a link up to that on our Facebook page at Minnesota Military Radio. Any final thoughts for our listeners about Pets Loyal to Vets?
Well, if there's a veteran out there that's listening to this radio show right now and you need help with PTSD or you have a traumatic brain injury and you've been assaulted in the service, there is help. Contact your county veteran service officer. They will help open the doors for you and get the help you need at the VA hospital.
And, of course, always the first stop for our veterans is your local county veteran service officer. Jeff, thanks for coming in to visit with us today. That was Jeff LeBaron, the founder of Pets Loyal to Vets. We're just about out of time. If you have a mailbag question or suggestion for a topic you'd like us to address, please go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. Click on Contact Us to send us a note. Thanks for listening to this edition of Minnesota Military Radio. I'd like to thank our guests for joining us this week, Tom Newman, Jeff LeBaron, Tim Leonhardt from the Minnesota Patriot Guard, Commissioner Larry Shelato of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and finally, Minnesota's Adjutant General, Major General Rick Nash. Please join us next week as we take an in-depth look at the lasting effects of combat on our troops and their families. That's coming up next weekend on this station or online anytime at MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. I'm Tom Lyons, and I hope that you make a difference in someone's life this week.
You've been listening to Minnesota Military Radio with Tom Lyons. Tom is the founder and owner of Phalon Partners Limited, a Twin Cities merger and acquisition firm. This has been a production of Clear Channel, MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com, the Minnesota National Guard, BeyondTheYellowRibbon.org, and the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Podcasts of the show are available at MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com.